The first reading this morning is taken from a recent email I received from the Reverend Joel Miller. Joel grew up in this church and is now the minister at our Buffalo congregation. He was also one of my best interns at my former congregation in Hayward, California. So I've known Joel for a very long time. He was here recently for Eric's installation, and we talked about this history, and I asked him to write it out for me. And so here it is. I can't remember who we had make that first chalice. It was thrown of clay, glazed to look bronze, to coordinate with the other decorations in the sanctuary at the time. What I do recall is the meeting that previous winter when I first asked to light the chalice. We had lit the chalice in children's worship when I was in religious education classes, but this had not happened ever in the Sunday morning adult worship. I had asked a Sunday school teacher about it once, and he explained that adults didn't light a chalice because Unitarians didn't have dogmas. I was 10 years old, and I wonder what dogs had to do with lighting anything on fire. 12 years later, after I had become the chair of the worship committee, I proposed to the committee that we light a chalice at the beginning of worship. I remember one man telling me that he thought that lighting a chalice was popery. I remember looking at him in utter confusion. I had no clue what a little bag of perfumed flowers my mother had in her guest bathroom had to do with lighting a chalice. As I asked what a popery had to do with lighting a chalice, the man began explaining popery as something Catholics would do. I was confused since I thought he was telling me that Catholics also lit a flaming chalice, while the rest of the committee was having a great laugh. By the end of all that confusion, the committee voted to try the chalice lighting for a while. There were some strong comments that Sunday morning, and I had several intense conversations in which I explained that lighting a chalice was something I wanted to do and that I sought the approval of the worship committee. I can't remember the name of the one guy who seemed most upset by it, but since no one could give me a rational reason, or really even an irrational reason, why having a symbol was somehow bad, I kept on lobbying for what I wanted. I lit the chalice on a few following Sundays, and so did Nancy Lee. After that, I don't recall hearing much more about it. I also bought the bell rung at the beginning of the service. The worship committee asked me to do so during my first year at Star King School for the ministry. I went to San Francisco and found it in a Buddhist bookstore and mailed it back to Columbus. I heard that the letter I wrote accompanying the box was read aloud at its first ringing. The second reading consists of a few lines from a much longer poem, An Atlas of the Difficult World, by the great American poet Adrian Rich.
Here is a map of our country. This is the desert where missiles are planted. This is the breadbasket of foreclosed farms. This is the birthplace of the rockabilly boy. This is the cemetery of the poor who died for democracy. This is a battlefield from a 19th century war. The shrine is famous. This is the sea town of myth and story when the fishing fleet went bankrupt. Here is where the jobs were on the pier processing frozen fish sticks. Hourly wages and no shares. These are other battlefields, Centralia, Detroit. Here are the forests primeval, the copper, the silver lodes, These are the suburbs of acquiescence. Silence rising fume-like from the streets. This is the capital of money, whose spires flare up through air inversions, whose bridges are crumbling. I promised to show you a map, you say. But this is a mural. Then, yes, let it be. These are small distinctions. Where do we see it from? Where do we see it from is the question.
When I first moved here to Columbus in 1998, it was a different city. There are new highway interchanges now, more lanes down 315, fresh buildings like the Glass Courthouse downtown, and my loft building is now just one of many such buildings downtown. Our own local Jenny's ice cream is famous around the country. Most of my friends import it, as a matter of fact. Our zoo and our libraries and our science museum have won accolades. And where once White Castle and Wendy's ruled, you can now find restaurants serving the foods of Zanzibar, Senegal, Ghana, Bali, Vietnam, Ecuador, Somalia, and Thailand, along with the growth of at least 10 new Asian markets and shops that sell halal meats. The Short North, once a neighborhood of terror and toughness, is now a destination. On the other hand, the city remains now a lot like what it was when I first moved here. It's a relatively easy place to get around. It's charming, with brick streets and domestic neighborhoods shaded with trees. It's a safer center for diverse sexualities, an urban haven for artists and dancers, a culture anchored by the many universities, colleges, and even seminaries that thicken on the landscape. Oh, there's still no trains connecting us to other great Ohio cities. There's no light rail and no signs of any light rail coming. But foolish me, I have hopes that even someday that will change. Things in Columbus have changed faster or slower, but other things have not so much changed as they have deepened, become more layered and nuanced. Oh yes, Columbus has changed over the last 70 years, a lot more than in the last decade. The famous arches of Arch City came down during the Second World War, and then they were put up in new form in the 90s. The last streetcar tracks were taken up and replaced by buses. The city has weathered a loss of industry, the economic effect of horrific and often quite controversial wars in Europe, in Asia, and in the Middle East. City and state government centers have sponsored hundreds of elections in the last 70 years, with contrasting results, welcomed either by despondency or smugness. The single skyscraper that existed in 1940, when this congregation was founded, the Levesque Tower, is now just a single gnarled old tree in a forest of sleeker young growth. Somehow, despite all of these changes, it's been Columbus, Ohio, the whole time. Columbus and its surrounding environs. It's always been Columbus for 70 years. And remember, Columbus and its suburbs have always been cities in America, the United States of America, for 70 years. Adrian Rich tells us something about that context, too. Here is a map of our country, she writes. This is the desert where missiles are planted. This is the breadbasket of foreclosed farms. This is the cemetery of the poor who died for democracy. Here is where the jobs were, hourly wages and no shares. There are other battlefields, Centralia, Detroit. Here are the forests primeval, the copper and the silver lodes. This is the capital of money. Adrian Rich wrote those words 16 years ago. But I've read some of these words in recent newspapers, haven't you? Foreclosure, missiles, the poor, hourly wages and no shares. Those are 2010 words. What I'm trying to say is that this congregation exists in time as well as in space. Space is merely signed by differing buildings. But our church exists also in time, and not just in time, but in the times. In other words, it is set into the various larger cultural movements weaving through our seven decades. Meeting in a house in Indianola, meeting in a smallish rectangular room made of gray cinder blocks. You can see a photo of that on the cover of your Order of Celebration. Meeting in a stucco-walled room with windows looking out onto a garden. Meeting in this large square room of windows and warmth, color and comfort. The congregation has changed in space. From the 30 or so who gathered in the house to the 400 or so who gather here on Sundays, well, that really is a different ball game, isn't it? 30, 400. But it's not different just because of bricks and mortar. We now live in a totally different era than Rod Serling lived in, for example, even though he was just as much a member of this congregation as many of you are. Rod Serling was a member of this congregation back in the days when Jack Hayward was minister. Back then, there was no flaming chalice lit at the beginning of the service. There were no little green stoles. There were no children's stories. Neither the gray hymn book nor the blue hymn book had been created yet. Ministers wore dark suits or black gowns. Colorful stoles had yet to be incorporated into our style. And though the sermons in those days dealt with love and justice, just as our present ones do, the sermons intersected with the culture of those days, not ours. For example, in the words of Rod Serling we read this morning at the time of the affirmation, he writes, "If we want to prove that God is not dead, we must first prove that we are alive." Those are great words. Those words, however, are directly referring to a theological movement of his day in the 60s, touted by Gabriel Vahanian, William Hamilton, and Thomas Altizer. Time magazine ran a very famous cover story about the God is dead movement. It was a very controversial story. And it was published just a short while before Serling wrote those particular words. So Serling was, in short, a man of his time. He was pre-Kindle, pre-computer, pre-cell phone, pre-Fox News and MSNBC. And yet he was part of this church. And after this church, he was also part of three other Unitarian Universalist congregations on the various coasts where he filmed his TV shows or wrote his famous teleplays. Yet just 10 years before he joined this particular congregation, the whole idea of a teleplay or a television show with science fiction episodes like The Twilight Zone was completely unheard of. No one ever imagined there was going to be vast networks, or thankfully, no one ever imagined there'd ever be any animation like the Flintstones. Their head was free of that. And yet they came, we saw, and they conquered. And in 1940, when our church was first gathered, when Woody Guthrie wrote, "This land is your land," and Dr. Seuss wrote, "Horton hatches an egg," no one was thinking about atomic bombs. No one was thinking about moon landings. Certainly no one was thinking about same-gender marriage. And no one then thought that the word man meant anything less than humankind, no matter their gender. And our hymn books were packed with male pronouns only. When Joel Miller was growing up in this church, he grew up in the older part of the building. This new center was not yet built when he was a child. And when he was very little, they didn't even light a flaming chalice anywhere, including in the classrooms. The symbol really wasn't used much till the late 60s, early 70s, and not until the mid-80s in many places. And there was resistance to it. After all, it was new, and I understand that. The symbol had a remarkable history, but nobody knew it, and no one taught it. Still, the kids thought that worship always began with such an act, and Joel, when he grew up, wanted to introduce this simple ritual to the adults. His story, as you heard it in the first reading, is a little masterpiece of misunderstandings, a series of innocent confusions. He thinks that dogma has to do with dogs and is confused. He is only 10 years old, after all. He thinks that Catholics have a ritual of lighting a chalice, and he is confused about that. He thinks that when one man thinks of ritual as potpourri, he is actually saying potpourri, and Joel expresses his honest bewilderment that a bowl of dried flower petals has anything to do with any of this. All of these misunderstandings served the cause of laughter, and laughter often lightens the load. The worship committee gave Joel their blessing to light the chalice, and so it has been ever since. Now, I would hope that at least some of you may have been surprised and maybe even a bit chagrined that someone who was a member of this congregation used the undeniably derogatory word potpourri, a word first coined in the violent days of Elizabeth I of England, and which gained popularity during the age of James I and the Guy Fawkes Rebellion. But remember, a congregation is not an island separated out from the world, but a place where the members have to deliberately work hard not to be tainted and distorted by the biases of a larger society. Arthur Schlesinger Sr., who taught at OSU, and whose son, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., was not only a Unitarian, but the greatest historian of liberal politics of the last century, once famously wrote, "The deepest bias in the history of the American people is anti-Catholic prejudice, and much of that is actually rooted in the upbringing of English colonists raised in Jacobean times." So I personally was not surprised when I heard Joel's story, but strangely, I was not discouraged either. After all, signing the membership book at a Unitarian Universalist congregation in whatever decade you do it is not a magic trick that turns us presto chango into perfected saints. No, claiming to be Unitarian Universalist means you are committing yourself to walking a path toward deeper awareness of self as well as the world. You are promising to struggle to be faithful to our ideals, proclaiming the inherent worth of every single person. To be a Unitarian Universalist is to struggle to make sure those ideals are not inadvertently tainted through our own laziness with the cruelties and corruptions of a world where unconscious bias, systems of oppression, entitled greed, and free ridicule have risen to high honor in many places, as many of the recent election ads made perfectly clear to me. As Adrienne Rich warns us in her poem, "I've painted a whole great mural of American life for you, all of it, the breadbaskets, the forest primeval, the copper, the riches, as well as the joblessness, the wars, Centralia, where a burning mine scorched the earth around it for months, or Detroit, where a city burned. And I was witness to that with my own eyes, thank you. The mural of America I have offered you," she said, "is complex and rich, with all the good and not so good images blended in our nation, blended in its eras." But she adds, "The real question is, where do we see it from? Where are we when we look? Are we seeing it from the vantage of pessimism and hopelessness? Do we see through rose-colored glasses? Oh, everything's going to turn out all right. Do we see through eyes of patriotic love? Are we cynical or even bitter? Critical of people who are cynical and bitter? Are our eyes veined with fear? How do we see the present era? And do we really think that we are seeing these things entirely differently from Americans alive during the 40s, or the 70s, or the 90s? Same thing holds true for our 7 decades of congregational history. As I see it, things have changed a lot in buildings, in size, in music programs, in rituals, in metaphors that are used in this pulpit, in language, and in organization. Those things, however, are incidentals compared to our faithfulness to core principles. When I look at our history, I think we have remained pretty steady in our faithfulness to principle. I think, in fact, that when the man on the worship committee was saying what he did, however reactionary that was, he was trying, albeit clumsily, to make sure we were not just toying around with religion, by borrowing without thinking or doing rituals by habit instead of with thoughtfulness. He wanted us to say what we mean and mean what we say, quoting Horton the Elephant. Ralph Waldo Emerson left the Unitarian ministry for that exact principle. So though I admit that the word popery is unfortunate and even vile, the idea of asking the question, are we being faithful to our stated ideals, is not a bad question. In fact, asking that question is central to our practice. It's one of our main taproots. But it's not more central to our chosen way of life than another taproot, questioning ourselves. Questioning ourselves about just how much we might be echoing mindlessly the culture around us, for good or for ill. Faithfulness to ideals is not the only taproot. Without this second practice of working to undo the negative effects of bad culture on our spirits over the last 70 years, we would have simply degenerated into a cozy club that, in Serling's words, was only sitting on the rubble of our own making. I'd like to think instead that by our faithfulness and by our self-questioning, we might, like Horton in the story this morning, hatch something new, something the world has not seen before. By being 100% faithful both to self-questioning and to our great ideals of reason and inclusiveness and liberty and love, I'd like to think that from our amazing roots might spring a tree of life the world has never seen before. A tree offering us shelter in storms, beauty to the eye, the fruit of many cultures and classes and genders and ways of life, for the nourishment of our spirits and for the healing of the world and for the healing of ourselves. So raise your glasses. Here's to the next 70 years of this congregation. Here's to its central Ohio city, Columbus. Here's to its nation. Here's to its world. Roots hold me close. May all that grows out of you and up from you serve to make us deeper and wiser and more whole through all the decades to come.